Hello, my name is Stacey and welcome to Run With Me On This, a podcast to motivate, educate and distract you. There are two versions of this podcast, so if you're hearing music right now, you've downloaded the music version. This is perfect for those of you wanting to listen whilst you're out for a run. The music is designed to be upbeat and keep you going for the next half hour or so. And I'll be featuring three great songs throughout the show from fantastic independent artists. The playlist will be available in the show notes. If you're thinking, hey, I don't hear any music, well, you've chosen the beat-free version. Feel free to listen whilst you chill at home or on the train or lying in bed. And don't worry, I'm not offended if my voice helps you fall asleep. Other than the music, both versions are exactly the same. This episode is all about money. Money, 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 money. Why were Swedish coins bigger than a dog? How did Hitler help America recover from the Great Depression? And are postage stamps legal tender? I'm going to answer all of these questions and so many more. So, if you're ready, why not? Run with me on this. We all know what money is, even if some of us don't have a lot of it. But where did it come from and why do we need it? Money in and of itself has no real value other than the cost of the materials used to make it. The value of money is what people and society place upon it. There has always been bartering. This is where someone might swap a bag of corn for a couple of chickens. People tended to barter with things they needed, but occasionally some nice beads or gems could be used to get the weekly groceries. This system was dependent on everyone wanting what the other person has to offer. But what if you don't want two chickens in exchange for your corn? What if you want a nice new pair of shoes, but the shoemaker has all the corn he needs? Well, instead of carrying around a bag of corn to barter with, why not have a token which represents the same value and can be standardised within a society? Hey, this sounds a lot like money, or more accurately, currency. The shekel is one of the earliest examples of commodity money, and its first recorded use was by the Mesopotamian civilization in around 3000 BCE. Commodity money actually has some value, in that it's made from a precious metal. It was originally used as a measure of weight rather than as money, and was equivalent to a specific weight of barley, which was the parallel form of currency at the time. From around 10,000 BCE, the Chinese moved from using actual objects, such as tools and weapons, as a medium of exchange, to using mini bronze replicas of those objects. I mean, this sounds super cute, but it was a bit impractical carrying around tiny daggers and spades in your pocket. And so, in 770 BCE, the bronze got squished into a circle shape, and hey presto, you have a coin. Although China is thought to have produced the first standardised coins, it was in Lydia, which is now Western Turkey, in 600 BCE that the first industrial coin manufacturer was set up. This is now known as a mint. A mint is a primary producer of a country's coin currency and has the consent of the government to manufacture coins to be used as legal tender. It was King Aliates who minted the first coin, which was made from electrum, which is a mixture of silver and gold that occurs naturally. Most coins around the world are based on these original coins in that they're made from silver, gold or bronze, or imitations of these metals, and they have an image on both sides, with one side usually depicting a human head. The introduction of these coins made Lydia one of the richest empires in Asia Minor. But the word mint isn't from Lydia. It's thought to come from the manufacture of silver coins in Rome in 269 BCE at the temple of Juno Moneta. This goddess became the personification of money, and her name, Moneta, was applied both to money and to the place where money was made, the mint. Silver and gold were the most commonly used metals for making money, as this allowed trade to be done with other countries. I mean, you may not speak the same language, but everybody recognises gold when they see it. Ancient Sparta, however, wanted to discourage foreign trade and so made their money from iron, which gave it very little value outside of the country. Now, Sweden doesn't have a lot of silver or gold, and so in the 17th century, they had to produce plate money. These were large slabs of copper, about 50 centimetres long and wide, with their value stamped onto them. They don't sound particularly practical. And you'd certainly know if your grandma had slipped one in your birthday card. While those in Europe were enjoying their coins, over in China, they'd gotten past all that and had moved over to paper money as early as 700 AD. In Europe, paper money didn't become popular until the 16th century. This paper money was originally issued by banks or private institutions, not by the government. Its main purpose was to act as a kind of IOU, so that someone could take their paper to the bank and exchange it for the equivalent value in silver or gold. The first paper currency issued by European governments was actually issued by colonial governments in North America. Because it took so long to get shipments between Europe and North America, the colonists ran out of money. To save them reverting to a bartering system, heaven forbid, the government issued IOUs that traded as currency. In Canada in 1685, French soldiers had been using beaver pelts as currency, but there were only so many pelts to go around, and real money was running low, which meant the soldiers weren't getting paid for their work. The intendant of finance, Jacques de Mille, had a brainwave. He confiscated all the playing cards in the colony, cut them up, wrote denominations on the pieces and signed them. He then gave them back to the soldiers as pay in lieu of gold and silver. Because of the chronic shortage of money, these little bits of card were being accepted readily by merchants and so circulated freely at face value. Many of the playing cards were not redeemed and continued to circulate as currency. But guess what? People were hoarding the silver and gold behind the scenes. When the Seven Years' War caused rapid inflation, the playing card money wasn't worth the paper it was written on. So everyone got out their silver and gold and started using that as currency, which kept the economy going. But anyone with a playing card banknote was unable to redeem it because France had gone bankrupt. Originally, a bank would only issue a banknote if they could back it up with silver or gold in their vaults, just in case you wanted to cash in your notes. Today, however, most national currencies have no backing in precious metals or commodities, and so are said to have value only by fiat. The term fiat comes from the Latin meaning let it be done. And yes, a fiat is also a small car, but fiat money is something altogether different. Fiat money is a currency established as money by a government that does not have intrinsic value. It only has value because the government maintains its value and those using it agree on its value. Fiat money can be any money declared by a government to be legal tender. But, unfortunately, if you produce too much fiat currency, you get what is called hyperinflation. Inflation occurs when the price of a country's goods and services rise, while there is a loss in that currency's real value. Hyperinflation occurs when inflation gets out of hand and prices of goods can be seen doubling literally every 24 hours. To combat the rapid rise in the price of goods, the government may produce more currency to circulate into general population, which further devalues its worth to those outside the country. After the First World War, hyperinflation affected the German Papier Mark, the currency of the Weimar Republic between 1921 and 1923. Instead of imposing a tax to pay for the war, Germany borrowed lots of money, sure that they would win and be able to pay it all back. Spoiler alert, they lost. They printed loads of money, but didn't have the commodities to back it up. In 1921, the Reparations Commission ordered Germany to pay billions of dollars to cover civilian damage caused by the war. Germany started giving them paper money, but the commission were like, nah, 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 we want this in gold. Germany gave them what they could, but remember, they didn't actually have anything. So with each instalment, their own currency was devalued further and further. Where they had originally had an exchange rate of 4.2 marks to the dollar, by 1922, this had fallen in value to 320 marks to the dollar. There was a sudden hyperinflation, and the mark fell to a whopping 7,400 marks to the dollar by the end of 1922. Germany had printed more and more money in an attempt to pay for reparations, but in doing so, they had completely devalued their currency. After Germany had repeatedly missed repayments, France ordered the reparations to be paid in goods rather than in money, and demanded coal as payment. French soldiers occupied the Ruhr Valley to ensure that they got paid. but the German government forced the miners to go on strike. But don't worry, everyone. The government still paid the miners by, yep, you guessed it, printing even more money. By late 1923, a loaf of bread cost 200 billion marks. 200 billion. It induces images of people queuing with wheelbarrows full of money just to get a pint of milk. More recently, Zimbabwe was hit with hyperinflation at a rate of 1,730% in 2006, up to 11,000% in June 2007, and by July 2008, the inflation rate was more than 11.2 million%. It peaked at an estimated 89.7 sextillion% by November 2008. The country just continued to print and issue larger and larger denominations, including a $1 trillion bill, until it eventually abandoned its currency and started using foreign monies. Goldsmiths in England had been craftsmen, bullion merchants, money changers and money lenders since the 16th century. But it was the scriveners who were the first to keep deposits for express purposes of relending them. A scrivener is a person who wrote letters for those that couldn't write, kept historical records for kings and noblemen, and later became accountants and public or civil servants. Merchants and traders who had amassed large hoards of gold entrusted their wealth to the Royal Mint for storage. In 1640, King Charles I seized all of that gold stored in the mint as a forced loan. He said he was going to pay it back, but he didn't. After that, the merchants preferred to store their gold with the goldsmiths of London in their private vaults. Gradually, the goldsmiths took over the function of the scriveners when it came to re-lending on behalf of a depositor. This is where modern banking practices started. When you put your money in the bank, you are allowing the bank to lend that money to other customers. Your money doesn't really exist. It's just a number in your account, but there's no physical pile of money attributed to your name. After 1694, the Bank of England was granted sole rights to issue banknotes in England, whereas in the United States, it wasn't until 1913 that the Federal Reserve Bank was granted similar rights. Remember checks? I used to use them to pay companies or tradesmen for services rendered because using my debit card was never really an option. Some people used them to pay for stuff in shops to save them having to carry cash around. As a student, they had the advantage that they would take a few days to clear so you could pay for something a few days before payday and would have money in your account before the check cleared. They're not used very often nowadays. I think the last time I was sent a check was probably a year ago when my dad sent me a check for my birthday. There is evidence of use of checks as far back as 321 to 185 BCE in India during the Maurya Empire. The Adesha was an order for the banker to pay money from an account to a third person. In the 3rd century, banks issued letters called a sark. These were more secure than real money when travelling between countries and could be used at other banks to withdraw cash. In 1717, the Bank of England first used pre-printed forms, which were printed on cheque paper, to prevent fraud. Various other methods of avoiding fraud were used over the years, including the introduction of machine-readable characters and cheque guarantee cards. Throughout most of Europe, cheques stopped being used in the 90s and the noughties. And although in the UK the use of cheques is still quite popular, more and more companies have stopped accepting them as a source of payment. But small checks are boring. What we all want is an oversized novelty check. But where did the big check come from? The earliest archived photo of an oversized check is from 1936 and shows the Nazi politician Julius Lippert presenting a check for 200,000 Deutschmarks to Hitler's best bud, Joseph Goebbels. Since then, competition winners and charity donators alike have brandished a great big check because, well, it's fun, isn't it? Nowadays, anyone with a bank account has a bank card to go with it. But bank cards are not a modern invention. In fact, the concept of using a card for purchases was described in 1887 by Edward Bellamy in his utopian novel, Looking Backward. Bellamy used the term credit card 11 times in his novel, though his description of a card for spending a citizen's dividend from the government rather than borrowing makes it more similar to a debit card than a credit card. Buying goods on credit became much more popular at the turn of the last century, and charge coins and other similar items were used from the late 19th century to the 1930s. They could be all sorts of shapes and sizes and made from things like celluloid, copper, aluminium or other metals. The charge coin had a hole in it so you could attach it to your keyring. It was usually used for just one store or company and had the customer's account number embossed on it. The coin could then be used to make an imprint on receipts to limit the chance of mistakes in writing down the account number. It wasn't until the 1940s that a card was available which allowed credit charges to be made at multiple stores. The first card allowed customers to buy airline tickets on credit from multiple airlines. The modern payment card was created in 1950 by Ralph Schneider and Frank McNamara, who founded Diners Club. It was the first general-purpose charge card, but consumers had to pay off the balance each month in full. In 1958, American Express and Bank AmeriCard, which later was renamed Visa, would offer credit with only a minimal fee needing to be paid back each month. The first credit cards worked like the charge coins, in that merchants would make an imprint of the card to get the account number. Those born before 1990 will remember the familiar scene of shopkeepers swiping a credit card over carbon paper. Then IBM invented the magnetic strip that was later added to credit cards. The magnetic strip contained information needed to validate payments, such as the name of the cardholder, card number, authorization code, and expiry date of the card. The first electronic transaction was made in 1973, but this involved a 5-minute phone call for authorization, not particularly practical. It wasn't until the 1980s that payments connected to the Visa and MasterCard networks, but a signature was still required. In 1975, the French inventor, Roland Marino, patented the chip card. By 1985, chips were widely used on bank cards, and in 1992 in France, chips were mandatory on all debit cards. In the UK, it wasn't until 2004 that chip and PIN cards were introduced and were made mandatory in 2006. The PIN, or personal identification number, replaced an easily replicable signature. The chip card is quicker and more reliable than the magnetic strip, which could be easily cloned. Now you may think, blimey, have we only had chip and PIN in the last 15 years? Well, count yourself lucky. The United States didn't get chip and PIN until, wait for it, 2015. Credit card machines were then connected to phone lines and eventually the internet for faster payments. Nowadays, most of us use near-field communication technology to make contactless payments. In the UK, this was first used by Barclays in 2007, and now NFC technology is not just in bank cards, but also phones and smartwatches. Bank cards aren't just used for buying things in shops. They let you get cash from an ATM or automatic teller machine. In the UK, we call them cash machines. The first ATM was launched in 1967 by Barclays Bank in the UK with the 4-digit PIN needed to withdraw money. But cash is being used less often, which means we may start seeing cash machines disappearing. In 2018, contactless and mobile payments overtook cash payments for the first time in history. But what does the future hold? One day we could be paying for stuff with our fingerprint or our retina and not need a piece of plastic at all. And what about cryptocurrency? I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I understand how it works, but most of you will have heard of Bitcoin. This is one of the first peer-to-peer digital currencies, launched in 2009. The weird thing is, no one really knows who invented Bitcoin. However, Satoshi Nakamoto is the pseudonym for the person or group of people who developed the software. Bitcoin is not backed by any government body, which means it's not legal tender. Despite this, there's nothing stopping shops, real ones and those ones online, from accepting payment in Bitcoin. I mean, legally, they can ask for bananas as payment if they want to. In these sorts of situations, the law says the vendor controls the transaction. So, if they want to accept Bitcoin, they can. But you can't force them to take Bitcoin to make a payment. Many people are purchasing Bitcoin for its investment value rather than as a medium of exchange. But given how new the concept of digital currency is, some say it is pretty much the highest risk, highest return investment that you can possibly make. I can't talk about money without mentioning one of the biggest financial crises the world has ever seen, the Great Depression. The Depression started in the US as a result of a major fall in stock prices in September 1929. On October the 29th, there was what is famously known as the Wall Street Crash, and worldwide panic set in, causing a subsequent devastating effect on the state of the economy throughout the 1930s. To understand how we got to the crash, maybe we should find out a bit more about stock markets and how shares work. When a company needs investment, it breaks the company up into little pieces, or shares, and sells those shares to investors. It's a bit like the guy at college who would ask 10 people for 10p to get some chips, rather than just asking one person for a pound. It's easier to find people willing to give a little bit of money, rather than the whole amount. Wall Street has been the centre for financial markets for over 300 years. During the 17th century, Wall Street was a slave trading marketplace and a securities trading site. There was actually a wall there, well, to begin with a wooden palisade, which is why some think it was originally known in Dutch as De Walstraat, when it was part of New Amsterdam. Oh, I can't stop thinking of that They Might Be Giants song. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why'd they change it, I can't say. People just liked it better that way. Sorry, I digress. Others say it was named after Walloons. Walloons are an ethnic group native to Wallonia in southern Belgium. They primarily speak Belgian French, Picard or Walloon, which are all known as Romance languages. Among the first settlers that embarked on the ship New Nederland in 1624 were 30 Walloon families. Peter Minuit, the person who bought Manhattan for the Dutch, was a Walloon. And why did they need a wall? Because quite frankly, they were murdering Gits. After signing a peace declaration with the Native Americans, the Dutch then went and massacred them. 120 natives were killed. When the surviving Native Americans retaliated, the Dutch put up a wall to keep them out. Typical. In the late 18th century, there was a buttonwood tree at the foot of Wall Street, under which traders and speculators would gather to trade securities. I haven't really been able to find out for sure what a buttonwood tree is. It's either a sycamore, a mangrove, or a plane tree. Whatever the species, it was the place to be if you wanted to make a deal. In 1792, 24 traders met under the buttonwood tree and made the Buttonwood Agreement, which aimed to standardise stock exchange and prevent dodgy dealings. This was the beginning of the New York Stock Exchange. Over the next 100 years, more and more businesses moved to New York to be near to the financial hub of the country, bringing more and more money to the city. In 1884, Charles Dow began tracking stocks, initially beginning with 11 stocks, mostly railroads, and looked at average prices for these 11. When the average peaks and troughs went up consistently, he deemed it a bull market condition. If averages dropped, it was a bear market. He added up prices and divided by the number of stocks to get his Dow Jones average. Dow's numbers were a convenient benchmark for analysing the market and became an accepted way to look at the entire stock market, and we still use it today. By the start of the 20th century, New York was second only to London as the world's financial capital. And so, we return once again to September 1929. The stock market was the best it had ever been. It wasn't just traders who were working the stock market, but any Tom, Dick or Harry could have a flutter, and in fact, they'd been encouraged to do so after the First World War. There was also the rising trend for buying things on credit. People were borrowing money to buy shares in a hope that the price of the shares would rise and they could recoup their money and pay off their debts. Banks were also getting in on the action, using their customers' money to play the market themselves. When Herbert Hoover became president in 1929, he'd made some promises regarding taxes, which promised to boost the economy. Unfortunately, the Senate blocked his plans, and the general public panicked. They started selling off their shares, which meant the prices started to plummet. And if you see that you're about to sink, obviously you jump ship. And so more and more people started to sell, sell, sell. On Black Thursday, October 24th, 12.8 million shares were sold. By the following Tuesday, also known as Black Tuesday, the economy had completely collapsed. Those trying to get their money back from the bank found that the bank had no money left. Thousands of banks had to close. Businesses that had sold their goods on credit or hire purchase couldn't recoup the money. Factories couldn't afford to make products that no one could buy. There was mass unemployment. Debts couldn't be paid. Suicides increased by 50%. It was a bloody disaster. So what ended the depression? Well, we have Hitler to thank for that. People were employed in the military to go and fight in the Second World War, and weapons and supplies needed to be made. Any surplus could be sold to other countries. People got jobs. America got money. Things were on the up and up again. By the time Reagan was president, that's the 80s for all of you youngsters out there, financiers on Wall Street were seen as cool guys who took no prisoners. It was fashionable to be a yuppie. Yuppie was short for young urban professional or young upwardly mobile professional. With this work hard, play hard mentality, inevitably came drugs, predominantly cocaine. Now I'm going to assume that you're all completely innocent and have never taken drugs, nor have any of you seen anyone else do it in real life or on TV. In which case, you'll need me to tell you that bank cards and banknotes are essential bits of kit when it comes to taking cocaine. The card is used to chop it up and put it into lines, and a rolled up banknote is perfect to use as a little nose straw to snort up the white stuff. Research has shown that every banknote in the UK is contaminated with cocaine within 2 weeks of it entering general circulation. In recent years in the UK, paper banknotes have been replaced with plastic ones. This has given rise to an increasing number of people getting Winstoned. Dun dun dun! But what does that mean? Well, Winston Churchill is the face on the new £5 note. People using the note rolled up to snort a bit of Charlie have found that they're cutting their nose on the edge of the note. Oh, poor things. Sharing the note may subsequently increase the risk of passing on blood-borne infections. Ew. These coke-fueled yupsters didn't learn anything from their predecessors, however. People seem to have forgotten that it's not good to buy shares with borrowed money. The Dow Jones Industrial Average took a bit of a dip and people got twitchy. On Friday, the 16th of October 1987, a few people started selling shares and the prices dropped. Investors had the weekend to freak out, and when the markets opened on Monday morning, everyone tried to get rid of their shares. Worldwide losses were estimated at $1.7 trillion. It took 2 years for the Dow to recover completely, and by September 1989, the market had regained all of the value it had lost in the 1987 crash. Now, I don't want to leave this episode on a low note, so let's end with a great bit of trivia that you can tell your mates down the pub. I'm here to clear up a bit of a myth that I certainly believed when I was younger. Are postage stamps legal tender? In short, the answer is no. The problem with stamps is that their value changes. If you have a first-class stamp that you bought 20 years ago, should that stamp be worth what you paid for it then, or the cost of a first-class stamp today? Well, 20 years ago, it would have cost you 27 pence. And today, a first-class stamp is, wait for it, 70 pence. People would start hoarding stamps knowing that in a few years' time, they could have doubled their value. That's not to say that stamps have never been used as currency. During the American Civil War, there was a shortage of coins. So in 1862, the US government authorized the use of stamps as currency. This gave the government time to produce more coins, and stamps were stamped out as a form of currency in 1876. The only thing classed as legal tender in the UK are coins from the Royal Mint. That's it, just coins. And shops don't have to take all of your spare change. You can only pay in 1 or 2 pence pieces up to the value of 20 pence. If you go in there with a jar full of pennies, the shopkeeper can tell you to do one. And whilst banknotes are legal currency, meaning that they were produced by the government to use as money, they are only legal tender in England and Wales, not in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Which means, and I know that this is a contentious issue, that although it is real money, shops anywhere in the UK are well within their right to refuse a Scottish banknote if they want to. But shops in Scotland can also refuse Scottish banknotes and English banknotes. The reason for this is that, strictly speaking, if you pay for something in legal tender, you have to pay the full and exact amount. If you give too much, the seller is well within their legal right to keep your money and not give you any change. So, if you're splashing around a £50 note to buy a packet of crisps, the shopkeeper doesn't have to give you your change, and there's not a single thing you can do about it. Okay, that's it for this episode. Thank you for listening, whether you're running, cycling, or doing the washing up. You can follow the show on Twitter at RunWithMePod and Instagram at RunWithMeOnThis. In 2 weeks' time, look out for the Jog On episode in your podcast feed. This will be a mini episode where I give feedback from listeners and tell you about some exciting new bands I've been discovering recently. Bye-bye for now, and remember, what I say may not always make sense, but run with me on this.